My guest today is author, theatre critic, actor and director, Andrew Ings. Good afternoon, Andrew.
Good afternoon, Bob. Nice to be here. Thank you for asking me.
It's a pleasure to meet you. You seem like an interesting fella. So let's find out all about you. Thanks for coming into Phoenix today. Reading your biography, you've done so many things in your career, it's difficult to know where to start. But I thought we'd start with your name. It's an unusual surname you have there, Ings, I-N-G-S. Do you know its origins?
Well, I remember when my kids were young, we went to York on a holiday. We went to the Viking Museum and we looked up various things, including the name Ings. And according to their records, Ings is a Viking word meaning water meadow. Now, whether that's accurate, true or not, I don't know, but that's what we read.
Okay.
And there are villages and estates and streets named Ings throughout Yorkshire and the north of England.
Okay, well, I found a definition of it that mostly agrees with what you said. I'll just read it all to you. It says, this unusual surname is medieval English but of Norse Viking pre-7th century origins. Ing was originally the name of a Norse god associated with fertility and thought to have the possible meaning of swelling.
Swelling? Oh.
So just how big is your swelling, Andrew?
No secrets given here.
Well, that's interesting. Yes, well, I'd never heard the name before.
It's an unusual name. You look in the phone directory, there's not many.
No, not many of you, right. Well, now, Andrew's written many articles for a range of titles over 30 years. These have included theatrical reviews for a number of newspapers and magazines, including The Guardian and The London Evening Standard. Other articles have been regarding lifestyle and modern day life. In addition, you've written pieces on cooking for men, health and exercise, cycling, country walking, health and safety and stress management. And your first book was published in 2001. So when did you realise you had the talent to write, Andrew Wood?
Well, it actually goes back a long way. Bearing in mind I'm retired now, but when I was a kid at school, I was a total dunce at maths, still am for that matter.
Okay, yeah.
I was kind of, I suppose, average at everything else, but I always got top marks for essays, always.
Right.
If somebody had picked it up, who knows, I might have written Harry Potter.
Okay.
But anyway, leave school, the years go by, and in the mid-80s, I decided to do an Open University course, which required 3,000-word essays every 2 weeks. And that got me back into writing.
Okay.
Plus the fact I was working for a company then and doing some training for them. And I remember going to Tate and Lyle, actually, to do some training.
Okay. Was it the one in Silvertown?
Yes, it was.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And after I'd done this training course to some of their staff, somebody there said to me, "Oh, could you write a piece on what you've done for our sort of in-house magazine?"
Okay.
So I said, "Yeah, sure. Just a page, whatever it was." And that sort of kicked me off, and I thought, well, if I could write for their magazine, I can write for others. Right. And I started putting my head together, which is difficult, always.
Yeah. And, I have the same problem.
And I started writing for all kinds of magazines. First of all, on the work stuff, which is not clever because we can all write about our jobs.
Right.
But then I started to expand and write about hobbies, write about this, write about that. And I'd done theatre reviews and stuff anyway for local paper way back before that. The weird thing is, and this does sound weird, I know, but I remember in my 20s thinking, when I retire, I'm going to be a writer, which was total fantasy.
Yeah, but it turned out.
But it's the way it is.
Great. And what was that feeling like when you had your first sort of independent article published? Was that
terrific?
Was that a good moment?
Yeah, it was great. Yeah.
You were also a contributor to a weekly radio program on the arts for more than 3 years. How did you enjoy that?
That was lovely. I live in Braintree in Essex and I've been there since '74. And I remember seeing, pure chance, I think, I saw an advert or something in the newspapers at that time, or maybe 75, that Radio Orwell, which was a commercial station in those days, was going to open up in Ipswich, and they were looking for ideas, contributors, whatever. And I thought, okay, we don't necessarily want another 24-hour pop station. I was well into theatre. I wonder if they want theatre critics or reviews or whatever.
Right.
And I wrote to them and ended up doing a weekly programme for 3 years. We used to go out on a Sunday night for an hour, and I used to cover theatre. Somebody else used to cover music. Somebody else used to cover art. So we went all around East Anglia, my wife and I, and we reviewed amateur theatre shows, some professional shows, did some stuff in the studio with interviews, and yeah, it was good fun.
Yeah, excellent.
Really enjoyed.
And you know, the one that I've got to ask about, you also appeared in the final episode of Blackadder. We must find out more about that. How did you end up appearing in that famous episode, and what part did you play?
Well, I have to say that's not strictly true. It wasn't the final episode. The one I appeared in technically was the final episode. It was the one that he did for the opening of the Dome.
Ah, the Millennium one.
The Millennium one. Yeah, the Millennium movie. And right. I was in that.
Okay. Oh, I was thinking of the First World War one.
But that was memorable.
That was the final episode, wasn't it? Yeah, it was. I'd forgotten all about that.
But yeah. I got into that through an agency, and I think it was quite funny because they built a sort of section about 50 yards long of Hadrian's Wall in Surrey.
Okay.
Or Sussex, I forget now where it was. Hankley Common.
Okay.
And it was, I suppose still is, several hundred square acres of what was then an army training range.
Right.
Undulating countryside, that the other. And on a ridge, they built this section of Hadrian's Wall. And I was one of a number of Scottish heathens in kilts and red wigs and stuff. And we were storming the wall, and it was good fun. It was a blazing hot day, I remember. It was really seriously hot.
Did you get to meet any of the cast?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, they were great. We had a bit of a chat and laugh, and it was good fun. It was a day to remember.
Yeah, okay. And how did you find Rowan Atkinson? Was he amenable to...
It was a little bit reserved, I would say, is the word. Not rude by any means, but reserved.
No, I guess they're under pressure.
Nice to be, you know, chat. But remember Tony Robinson, Stephen Fry was there, of course. And yeah, a bunch of guys. And
yeah, excellent. Yeah. Well, that's quite an experience.
It was indeed. Yeah.
Now, one of your publications was a book on the history and birthplace of British rock and roll entitled Rocking at the Two Eyes Coffee Bar. Now, I know the legend of the Two Eyes Coffee Bar, but I didn't really know any of the details. But before we talk about that, let's get a feel for the period with a track from one of the stars who was discovered performing at the Two Eyes. Now, that was Tommy Steele, who at the time was performing with the Vipers. And the track we're going to hear is Let's Rock with the Caveman.
The old time cave dweller lived in a cave. This is what he did when he wanted to rave.
Now, London in the 1950s was vibrant with artists, musicians and intellectuals. Right in the heart of the city, Soho was like a village community filled with cafes, pubs and clubs. And on one tiny stage of one of these, the Two Eyes Coffee Bar, many legendary musicians began their careers. So, Andrew, what led you to end up writing a book on the Two Eyes Coffee Bar?
Well, it's strange, actually, how, you know, when you're young, you sort of can't see how necessarily life is going to pan out for you. But when you get to our age and you look back, you think, oh, yeah, it clicks together like a jigsaw puzzle. So when I was 18, I was living in Clacton. Start again. I was born in Retford, went to London when I was, you know, very, very small, lived in Wood Green and Haringey. When I was 12, we moved to Clacton. When I was 18, I left home, went back to London and joined the Bedsit crowd. So I'm 18 in 1960, and I'm working as a backstage dog's body at the Queen's Theatre, Shaftesbury Avenue, at where Les Miserables is at the moment. And I'd been there, I don't know, a couple of weeks, and one of the guys I got to know, he said, hey, do you fancy a bit of music tonight after the show? So I said, yeah, sure. So we go out the stage door, round the corner, probably 50 yards top whack, into Old Compton Street, to a place called the Two Eyes Coffee Bar.
Right.
And that was my first introduction to the Two Eyes. And I suppose I was in London at that time, two and a half years. We used to go around down there a couple of nights a week. Cut then, the years go by, to about 8 years ago. And I was again working at the Queen's Theatre on Les Mis.
Right.
And I'd had a meeting in the morning, and I came out of stage door at lunchtime, heading through Old Compton Street to grab a pie and a pint sort of thing before my afternoon meeting. As I came round into Old Compton Street, there were barriers, there was a crowd of people, there were cameras. I basically ignored it. I thought, they're filming another EastEnders or something. Right. You see it in London here and there, and I just basically ignored it.
Yep.
And I went into a little cafe further along the road for, I suppose, half an hour-ish, 45 minutes. As I came out, two guys walked past roughly my age, immaculately dressed as teddy boys.
Okay.
And I did a double take. What's going on?
Yeah.
Oh, they said, they're unveiling a plaque for the Two Eyes Coffee Bar.
Right.
Well, at that point, my afternoon plans changed.
Okay, yeah.
And I spent the rest of the afternoon talking to a lot of the guys there, and I thought, there's got to be a book in this.
Yeah.
And that is exactly how it happened.
Excellent. Well, now you've written that book. It's called Rocking at the Two Eyes Coffee Bar, which basically tells the story of the Two Eyes. Can you give us a little potted history of the Two Eyes? And
It was opened in 56, in April 56, and it was owned by two Australian wrestlers. But before that, the Eyes, somebody said to me, well, where did the Eyes come from? Originally, it was owned by three brothers, the Irani brothers, I-R-A-N-I.
Okay.
One of them went home to wherever. That left two, and they called it the Two Eyes, and that's how the name originated. It sounds corny, but
amazing.
It's true.
Yeah.
And then two Australian wrestlers came over and bought the place and started to promote music down there, and very, very quickly it became the place for musicians to go down there. So what I've done with the book, I've actually done a history of Soho, which was then and still is a village in many ways, and I interviewed 40 people who went to the Two Eyes, many of whom became big stars.
Right.
Others who lived and worked in Soho knew the area, knew the con men, knew the gangsters, people like me. I went there as a punter. And so it's a collected history of really the birthplace of British rock and roll.
Yeah, and you know, there were a good many stars that actually came to fame through the Two Eyes, wasn't
there? Indeed, there were.
You also had people working there as waiters who later became famous, wasn't there? I think Mickey Most was one
indeed.
Of them. Yeah.
Yes.
There was another one who I can't find in my notes at the moment. Can you,
there was an. It was quite funny because I was for a while a member of a theatre company at the Mercury in Essex, in Colchester.
Yeah.
And I was when I was planning and talking about this book, one of the ladies there, she's a year or two older than me, she said, oh, she said, the Two Eyes, yeah, I used to work there and serve coffee.
Oh, really?
And I thought, well, this is a small world. And yeah. She was then 18 or something in 1957, 58. I didn't get there till 1960.
Okay.
And she was there a year or two before me. And she was working the first Gaggia coffee machine in.
Oh, right, okay.
So it's a small world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I found that other name now. Composer Lionel Bart, apparently.
Oh, yes.
Could be found in the Two Eyes. Serving customers.
Indeed.
And other famous people who sort of went through there. Adam Faith, who was with his band The Worried Men at that time. Marty Wilde, Vince Taylor, Terry Dean. They all made their debuts there and became a bit of the history of British rock and roll.
Indeed.
And
Wee Willie Harris, of course, with pink hair.
Yeah, yeah. And probably, of course, the most famous one of all was Harry Webb.
Indeed.
Yes, that's Harry Webb with the Drifters and a track called Move It. Harry Webb, of course, became Cliff Richard. And Cliff was a contributor to your book, I believe.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
There's a quote on the back here. For me, the Two Eyes played a vital part in my career. I played to my first rock audience. I knew what I wanted to be and I had the feeling I could make it.
And sure did.
Yeah, sure. So, and you spoke to Sir Cliff, we should call him now.
I suppose, yeah.
In your research for the book, I believe. Any of the other stars did you get to speak to?
Yes, Marty, Vince Seeger, Terry Dean, Willie Harris. Willie Harris, I must tell you this story about Willie Harris. Yep. He lives down in Carshalton. And I went, the first time I went, I'd met him a couple of times prior, and I went to see him to do sort of a little recording interview to take home and stuff. And we were sat there chatting away, and his wife brought us some tea, and that was nice. And then I said, oh, I'm going to take your photograph, Willie. So he said, oh, hang on a minute. He said, and he called his wife, Sheila. Where did I leave my teeth? Now, if you think about it, if you've got false teeth, okay, you'd leave them, the answer you'd expect would be the bathroom or the bedroom.
Right.
Willie, you left them in the car. I'll never forget that.
Why would you do that?
Yes. Exactly, yeah. Why would you do that?
Yeah, oh, well. Well, do you know what? It's 8 minutes to two. I'm so enjoying talking to you, Andrew, but we're going to have to move it along now. We've talked about Rocking at the Two Eyes Coffee Bar, but you've got another book out as well, with a bit of a strange title. It's A Nipperkin of Buncombe. Now, what is this all about?
It actually is a collection of scripts for performance. They are comedy sketches and monologues for the stage, screen or radio. Some could be done on the radio. They're very easy to stage. They don't need big sets. It's just a table and a chair, maybe.
Okay.
Or if a monologue, obviously, is nothing. And they're not politically correct. They're not obscene, but they're non-PC.
No. Okay, right. And I believe some of these sort of playlets, if you want to call them that, based on some of your own experiences in life.
Yes, they are indeed.
Would you care to give us an example?
Yes, indeed. Some years ago, I was working at the Tate Gallery, and I was down in the staff canteen one day, and just sitting there having a sandwich at lunchtime, and I was looking around, and on the wall there were various artistic things, one of which was a picture frame, about a foot square, if I remember rightly, glass-fronted, just like a picture frame, behind which were two pieces of toast. And I kid you not, a kid of five could have done it. And that was it. And I made some... that's artistic. Yeah. And then, of course, there was the unmade bed and the Turner Prize. So the Turner Prize kicked me off into a sketch, because I think some of the Turner Prize things are, frankly, ridiculous. I mean, we all have unmade beds every day at home, but why is one particular, and that sort of thing. So I have written a sketch about the Turner Prize. I've written a monologue about how to go supermarket shopping and annoy all the other shoppers in the aisles by blocking the aisles, blah blah blah. There's all kinds of stuff in there. It's all, my wife calls me a ranter when I'm writing this stuff, but I mean, it's they're visions on life, and they're not politically correct.
Okay, it's really interesting. Well, so that's your two books you've written so far. It's Rocking at the Two Eyes Coffee Bar and A Nipperkin of Buncombe. Any more in the pipeline?
There's another one coming out in the spring. I don't have a date yet, but it's been accepted by the publisher. It is called From Page to Stage, and it is a straightforward book, how to form a theatre company, be it amateur, and how to work all the things that you need to do right up to the first night of the first production, based on the lifetimes of experience.
You've got first-hand experience of all
yes,
that.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
Yeah, wonderful. Okay, now, I know for a fact that your existing publications are available on Amazon. Where else can you get hold of, or where can people get in touch with you?
Well, if I give you my email address, and if anybody wants to get in touch with me, I have some copies at home. I'd be more than happy to sign them and, whatever.
Okay, beautiful.
My email address, then, is andrew.ings, that's I-N-G-S, andrew.ings at talk21.com. Andrew.ings at talk21.com.
Okay, right. Well, what I'm going to do later on today, I'll put our little chat up on our website with details of how to contact you. So if anyone's missed that, if you check the Phoenix FM website about 6 o'clock this evening, you'll be able to get all those that information there. I mean, that's excellent, Andrew. In fact, I feel like that half an hour has just absolutely flown by. I've much enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you so much for coming into Phoenix.
Thank you for asking me.
And perhaps you'd like to come back and see us again sometime, perhaps when your next book comes out. How about that?
I'd love to do that.
Lovely. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Bob, very much. Thank you.
This is Phoenix 98 FM.